piano singing his song. All the little birds on Jay Bird Street love to hear the robin go tweet, tweet, tweet. Rockin' Robin, tweet, tweet, tweet. Rockin' Robin, tweet, tweet. Blow, rockin' Robin, cause we're really gonna rock them tonight. Welcome, everyone, to another edition of Community in Depth. That theme music means our friends from the Carpenter St. Croix Valley Nature Center are here. And today we want to say welcome to Jesse Eckrode and Katie Newland. And they are here to tell us about some exciting news on their Wisconsin campus. They brought some wildflowers I can't wait to talk about. But I would like to please bring up a very distasteful topic before we get going.
I know what you're going to ask.
Mind reader.
You know what? And because I know you so well, Mo,
yes,
I knew that
do.
This is something that would gross you out. It
yes.
actually kind of grosses me out, too. Anybody that lives in Hastings near a river right now is probably gruesomely aware of the mayfly hatch that just happened a couple of days
okay,
ago.
Okay, first of all, it's not even truth in advertising. Why are they called mayflies when we're in July?
That's a very good question. So I actually don't know specifically why mayflies. Also, June bugs. We call them June bugs,
yes.
But they're not necessarily always out in June. But yeah, they hatch in these gigantic numbers.
No kidding.
And when they're young, they're actually in the water. So their larval stage is in the water.
When does that happen? Was that this year?
So what happens, okay, so with this big hatch that just occurred, and now we're seeing like the dead bodies of these bugs everywhere, which are really kind of stinky and gross.
Right.
But the reason that they all emerge and then die so quickly is that their one job as adults is to mate and lay eggs. So they only live for a couple of days before dying. So they will mate and lay eggs in the water, which will then
so you're
some
talking
of them
about
overwinter
the,
even.
What?
Yes.
So they're in the Mississippi River.
Yes. It, actually in lots of different water bodies. Mm-hmm. Mississippi River, St. Croix River, lakes, wetlands. And they're actually, even though they're kind of gross, they're actually a really good indicator of water quality. Because since in their larval stage they live in the water, if we are not seeing mayflies, that's actually an indicator that water quality is really, really poor because they're sensitive to pollution. But when you see them in huge numbers like that, it's an indicator that the water quality is pretty good because the little squeebies, the little larval guys can survive in those waters.
So when you say that some of these could have wintered, how in the world could they have wintered?
That's a great question. So there's actually several different types of aquatic insects that are aquatic their whole life or only aquatic for part of their life that overwinter in the water under the ice. But other animals do it too. We've got different types of amphibians mm-hmm. that do that. I actually just raised a green frog tadpole that they overwinter. Their bodies are just more well adapted to dealing with those cold temperatures than our mammal bodies are.
I still don't quite understand it. So these mayflies that were in the water not too long ago,
mm-hmm.
what became of them? They hatched and they mated and now they're dead already?
Yes, the adults. And believe it or not, Mo, there's...
What do you mean the adults? What happened? Are there babies that were...
Well, they just laid eggs. So those eggs will develop into a larva.
Next year?
It will take a little bit of time depending on the species. You know, some insects have a very short life cycle from the time that they're an egg to the time that
kidding.
They're an adult. But some of them, like mayflies or dragonflies, can live a year or more in their larva stage before they turn into adults. So think about a butterfly.
Right.
The larva is the caterpillar and then it pupates and then it becomes an adult. So what we're seeing on the bridges everywhere, the adult mayflies, is the equivalent of like an adult butterfly.
Not quite.
not quite as cute. Definitely not. But yeah, they're really remarkable animals, even though they are kind of icky. And believe it or not, there's actually tons of different kinds of insects that have a very, very short life as mm-hmm. adults.
So the purpose of them is what?
That's a great question. We actually get lots of people who say, well, bugs are gross, or I don't like snakes, or mice, or, you know, whatever kind of animal people kind of find repulsive in some way. The question is, well, what good do they even do? And what I try to say to everyone is, even if it's an animal that I think is gross, like adult mayflies, they all have a really important part in the ecosystem. Okay. Everything's connected in nature. So even if it's something that we think is gross, those mayflies in their adult stage, but also when they're larvae, are food for other predators that are farther up the food chain. They also, those bugs, they will eat things that are part of the food chain too. So other smaller insects, or they help to keep populations of algae or other plants under control. So even if you think that something's weird and gross, they're busy out there in the natural world trying to help, you know, keep things balanced.
So how much longer will this dead body stage last in Hastings?
Depends on how quickly we can clean it up.
Oh, is it?
Because the hatch happened. The hatch is done. Oh. You will occasionally get a few individuals who kind of emerge later than the other ones. But for the most part, they're done, that particular species. That's not to say that there might not be another species that could and will emerge later on in the summer. But this particular species of mayflies, they come out in mass all together to mate, and then they die. And then we're shoveling them off the bridge and sweeping them off of our sidewalks. And that's just a natural part of their life cycle.
So we're good before Rivertown Days, which is coming up at the middle of the month.
Yes, we will not be inundated with mayflies at that time.
Thank you so much for sharing that.
Oh,
that's
of course.
So interesting, Timmy. You brought in some wonderful wildflowers, I would assume.
Yes.
And they're just, there are many colors, there are many different sizes and designs, and tell us about wildflowers.
Yeah, I thought that if we were going to spend a little bit of time talking about the mayflies, which are kind of ucky, we should spend some time talking about something that people
Absolutely.
Really like, which is flowers. And even though people are drawn to the beauty of flowers, there's so much more to plants than just those pretty blooms. So a lot of the flowers, the plants that I brought with today, have really interesting adaptations that we might not think of. So first of all, a lot of the plants that I already that I brought in are blooming currently, but I did bring in some seed heads from plants that had bloomed last month or more recently and have now gone to seed. So this one here is from lupin. And lupin is that really beautiful kind of bluish purple flower that you see out in prairies in June. So what's interesting about this one is that it flings its seeds. The pods, when they are first kind of drying out, are flat. But as they dry, there's a pressure on the pod that they will then snap, and the seeds are tossed away from the plant.
So it makes the field even more prolific.
Exactly, exactly. And so that's a meaningful adaptation for spreading those seeds. The same, although in a different form.
Have you ever seen that happen?
I have. It's kind of remarkable.
Really cool.
There's a few different kinds of plants that do it, that you'll just be minding your own business on a walk, and all of a sudden out of the corner of your eye, you'll see the pod pop.
So cool.
Yeah. And then another really common form of seed dispersal that we see is like this. It's commonly called goat's beard. But it's basically that plant you see on the side of the highway that looks like a dandelion on steroids.
Okay.
It's got the huge seed heads with the little kind of floaty umbrella seeds on them. And that's a specific adaptation for seed dispersal as well. The wind picks these up and takes them away from the plant, as opposed to the plant flinging the seeds away that the lupin does. So there's a couple of cool really seed heads there. And then I also have a selection of plants that are blooming right now, some of which are native to this area and some of which are not native to this area.
So when you say they're native, did Carpenter bring them in, or did they somehow come here?
Very good question.
I always think that invasive species are really exciting to talk about because not a lot of people know about them. You might be thinking, invasive, does that mean bad? What does that mean?
Right, right.
So an invasive species is different than an introduced species. An introduced species is one that, say, Carpenter Nature Center, I'm just going to make up a plant, the La 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 plant. And we said, this La 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 plant is going to do really great here, and it's going to do great things for this ecosystem. And we put it there for specific reason, and it does good. However, an invasive plant is one that was introduced either on purpose or on accident that does not do well and harms the ecosystem, or maybe...
Like buckthorn or something?
Yes.
Exactly.
Oh, that's,
yes.
That's a swear word at the nature center. No, that buckthorn.
Don't like that.
Gosh
swear.
Darn it.
And so a lot of invasive species can come in from things simply as like wind bringing seeds in, or shoes. When you're hiking, it's important to brush off your shoes because maybe in the mud you get a seed stuck at the bottom of your shoe, and then maybe you went for a hike on a different trail and that seed takes off, and seeds are really durable and they'll plant anywhere. So they can kind of come from anywhere. Or even if you think about it, say if a deer is eating a plant and has those seeds in its belly, it can go and scat somewhere and then they're spreading seeds there. So they come from all around, and some of them are really pretty, so it's hard to think of them as an invasive species.
Right, and it's oftentimes those pretty ones that have their backstory is that they were brought here as a garden plant from Europe or Asia, that we valued them because they're beautiful, planted them in our yards, and then they started to spread. So that's the case with all of these plants.
Really? So tell some of the names, please.
Absolutely. So this one here is St. John's wort, which some people might be familiar with for its medicinal properties.
How could I make my memory better? Do I eat this?
Oh, that's a great question. So St. John's wort, I would have to do a little bit more research into for what the medicinal properties are. But this is one, oh, and fun fact about this, they call it St. John's wort because apparently it blooms around St. John's birthday.
Oh, who knew?
But speaking of weird plants,
what's the wort part?
So wort in this case is spelled W-O-R-T. So not wart like we think of as a weird growth. So that's an kind of a misnomer as far as this is concerned. So this is medicinal, even though it's invasive and we don't want to have it. A native, though, flower that also has medicinal properties is this one here. This is called yarrow. So this one, a lot of people will recognize. It's got a big kind of white flower head, and the leaves are almost fern-like or feather-like. And this is one that I'll harvest from my backyard. It's good for your digestive system. It can help out with gut health and things like
so
that.
So do you put this in your salads? What do?
You could. Speaking of salads, though, I think the best salad green is dandelions.
Oh, tell us.
Very good. Mo doesn't believe me. But I think dandelion
green. What are we having today for dinner?
Yeah, there's actually a lot of different plants that are edible that you wouldn't expect.
So what part of the dandelion? Is it the flower?
Or you can eat the flowers and the stems and the leaves. Not so much the... I don't know what you do with the root, per se.
I wouldn't want to eat the root.
No, especially because it has all of that milky sap.
And why would we eat this?
Very nutritious.
It's nutritious.
Much more nutritious than something like iceberg lettuce, packed with nutrients that are really good for
you. But don't you think we should be careful? We shouldn't just go out to our... What if there's fertilizer on it or something?
That is an excellent point. We do, if we're going to get into foraging, need to be careful about what we are picking, whether it's plants or berries or things like that, because you might misidentify something and pick something that's actually poisonous. So you have to do your homework to make sure you're choosing the right species. And you also have to forage from places that have good conditions. So like you said, no fertilizers, no pesticides, no other like weird chemical things that might be going on in that area. So, you know, natural prairies or woodlands are some of the best places to do foraging.
So what is that beautiful orange flower?
Ooh, I'm so glad you asked that, Mo. This is butterfly weed, which is a relative of milkweed.
Oh, it's so pretty.
And it's called butterfly weed because the butterflies love it.
Do they?
Yeah, absolutely. So you'll see the monarch caterpillars on this one here, and then the adult butterflies feeding off of the flowers. And butterfly weed is this really beautiful, bright orange, as opposed to the more subtle pink of a milkweed, but they're very closely related. So that's a really beautiful, eye-catching one.
And is that clover? What is that?
Yes, see? Mo, you always are hard on yourself that I don't know anything.
I don't know
these plants, or I don't know stuff about animals. Yes, you do. Yeah, this is a clover.
Oh, that is such a sign of summer. I love that.
They're just so beautiful.
These
purple clovers are a native. There are some types of clovers that are not, but this is a really common one that you would see. Speaking of beautiful native flowers, this one here is actually one that some people will plant in their gardens because it's beautiful. This is Queen Anne's lace.
It's gorgeous.
Yep. That one I actually found on the roadside on my way here. I'll do anything for my interviews with you, Mo.
Thank you.
Including pulling over in weird spots on the way to pick flowers.
Beautiful.
That one is tricky, though, because you're oftentimes finding that growing alongside a really invasive, harmful plant called wild parsnip that looks very similar but is a yellow bloom instead of white. And, you know, we were talking about crazy plant adaptations earlier. The sap of wild parsnip is so toxic that it causes chemical burns on your skin.
Whoa.
Yeah.
So be careful.
Yeah, so be careful. I tell folks to just kind of stay out of the ditch in those disturbed habitats. There's a lot of different plants that might have different types of sap or resins that can be harmful to you.
So what is the tall, skinny one with all the buds on it?
Ooh, this one here. This one. I want you to touch this because the texture of it is just really fascinating. Oh. It's so sturdy. And I actually took a picture that I will send you.
So pretty.
This is just the flower head that I harvested off of this. This is a plant called giant mullein, and this is not native, but there's a lot of native animals that do like the flowers or the seeds. This is called giant mullein for a reason. It grows to 6, 8, 10 feet tall in some cases.
Wow.
So this is growing along the driveway at our Wisconsin campus where I harvested a lot of these flowers, and I took a picture. They tower above my head.
Amazing.
They're amazing.
Let's talk about your Wisconsin campus.
Yes.
Because you have great news to share.
Oh my gosh, yes. So after 35 some years of dreaming and planning and fundraising and talking to community members, we are finally opening a visitor center building on that property. We previously did not have facilities there, so no running water, no flushing toilets. And it was a beautiful property, but access for folks was difficult without the facility. So this weekend, July 9th and 10th, is the grand opening of the Al and Lori Hine Visitor Center. And our staff is kind of happily scrambling around, putting the last touches on the building and plans for the weekend. And we couldn't be more excited about that. And as is the case with our events or different operations at the Nature Center, if people want more information about that, just visit our website. It's an easy one to remember, carpenternaturecenter.org.
And who are Al and Lori Hines?
That's a great question. Al and Lori Hine are the couple that donated the original parcel of land that became our Wisconsin campus. So it was 80-some acres, and over the course of the years, we acquired more property. We now have 300 acres over on our Wisconsin property, and we built the new building right adjacent to that original parcel there even. So the Al and Lori Hine Visitor Center is located near the Al and Lori Hine Woods, and we're very excited to honor their memory and to honor all of the donors and the people that have made our project possible.
Well, congratulations to you. That's so wonderful. Good luck with your weekend of a celebration. We want to thank our guests today, Jesse Eckrode and Kate Newlin, and they are here representing the Carpenter St. Croix Valley Nature Center. Always so fun to get caught up with you. Thank you so much for coming in today. And you are listening to another edition of Community in Depth on AM 1460 and FM 97.7, KDWA in Hastings.
Tweet, 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 rockin' Robin, tweet, tweet, rockin' Robin, tweet.